Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Thank you for being with us here on Balance of Power, live from Washington. I'm Joe Matthew. Indeed, it's good to see you on Bloomberg TV and radio as we follow President Trump north of the border to the G7 in Canada, commenting earlier that Iran wants to talk. This, of course, following reports that Iran was looking for off-ramps following a brutal weekend of missile attacks by Israel. Of course, that went back and forth with a series of rounds. The president speaking earlier as he appeared with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, as you heard here on Bloomberg. Listen.
They'd like to talk, but they should have done that before. I had 60 days, and they had 60 days, and on the 61st day, I said, we don't have a deal. They have to make a deal. And it's painful for both parties, but I'd say Iran is not winning this war.
Not winning this war. Asked about reports Iran wants to work toward a resolution, President Trump responding, they'd like to talk, but they should have done that before. This following a report from the Wall Street Journal saying as much, that Iran was signaling through intermediaries that it hoped to return to the negotiating table. This is where we start our conversation, I'm glad to say, with Ron Dermer. Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., is with us live right now on Bloomberg TV and radio. It's great to have you with us, sir, and appreciate your time today. Can you confirm that these reports are true? Have you heard outreach from Iran?
Well, there's some reports, and then the Iranians denied it, and then they may be passing messages through interlocutors to the United States. I mean, you never know with the Iranians what they're actually doing. But what I can tell you is what's happening in the battle is they're losing. As the president said, I think he was very diplomatic, and he said Iran is not winning this war. They're losing this war because Israel's determined to remove two existential threats to our country. I mean, remember, Iran is a country that openly calls and actively works to destroy Israel. And they're on a path to building nuclear weapons. And we want
to
remove that
the
threat. We want to remove the ballistic threat. I'm sorry?
No, understood. So then, is it too late, is my question. Do you need to see the destruction of Iran's nuclear program, its nuclear facilities, before you ever consider going back to the table?
Well, let's remember what happened a couple months ago. The president talked about a 60-day timeline. I was with the prime minister when he went to Washington. And the president told the prime minister, look, he wants to give Iran a last chance to see if we can reach a deal. But what were the outlines of that deal is that Iran was going to have to dismantle its military nuclear capability. That's what was put on the table. And the president has been very clear about this from the beginning, not just the beginning of his presidency. He's been saying this for years. Iran must never have a nuclear weapon. And he's been very clear that Iran cannot have a nuclear enrichment capability, which is how you get the fuel for nuclear weapons. So then you don't have to really trust whether Iran has it or not. If they have no fuel for the car, then it's not a problem. And he gave it time, several weeks. His special envoy, Steve Witkoff, had several rounds of discussions, about five rounds of discussions. Mm-hmm. We were in close contact with them throughout, and they were very clear of what was going to be their red lines in a deal. And unfortunately, Iran thought that they could string these talks on forever and that there wasn't going to be any deadline. And it was clear to us in the last few days that there was no chance that Iran was going to agree to it. Will Iran agree to something else? Now, I don't know. But remember, one of their sites has already been dismantled by us. That's the Natanz enrichment facility. Yes. And we're also basically taking out their missile production factories as well. So we're going to go about our operation to remove these two threats. Whether Iran will decide to meet with the United States and agree to terms that they should have taken a month ago or 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, you know, that's up to Iran to decide.
Okay. All right. That's very important, Minister Dermer. I want to go a little bit further down that road with you because we heard from National Security Advisor Hanegbi, who said that Israel can tackle Fordo, the site, the enrichment site at Fordo, deep underground alone. The conventional wisdom here is that you need of the U.S. to help with that by way of bunker busting bombs, the Moab included. Is the destruction, Minister, of Fordo the end game? And do you need U.S. help to do it?
I'm not going to get into operations, this or that operation. I hope by now people will not underestimate Israel's will and capability of doing something. It's doing some things. And when we start a military operation, you saw that with Hezbollah, with the beepers. You've seen what's happened in Gaza. You've seen what we've done as we're fighting this seven-front war. So I think it's safe to say that you shouldn't underestimate Israel's capability to deal with threats. What's important to understand, Joe, is that Israel started this operation to remove two threats to the very survival of Israel. We talked a little bit about the nuclear, but there's also the ballistic missile threat. Some of your viewers have probably seen those scenes from Israeli neighborhoods where you had a direct hit of a one-ton missile. That's like a bus filled with explosives flying through the air and hitting a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Now imagine a country the size of Israel, which is all the size of New Jersey, that Iran would fire 10,000 or 20,000 of these rockets. And they have plans to build 300 of these a month, 3,000 a year. You're going to have 10,000 every 3 years. This is not a threat that we can tolerate. So we've launched an operation to deal with both of those threats. And on day four, I can tell you, we're ahead of schedule of where we want it to be. And we're going to win this war with Iran. And
so
what happens afterwards, hopefully, will turn the whole region to peace. Remember, we were dealing with the Abraham Accords in the first term, and I'd like in the second term of President Trump to expand that circle of peace.
Well, before we go that far, Minister, how far are you ahead of schedule? How far has the Iranian nuclear program been set back?
Well, it's day four. We've taken out their main scientists. Iran has the equivalent of the Manhattan Project, you know, that effort to build a bomb by the United States before World War II that ultimately led to victory in Japan. So Iran has this Manhattan Project, and the main scientists were all taken out in the first few minutes of this operation. And we've taken out information that they need for nuclear weapons, and then facilities like the Natanz enrichment facility, which is their main enrichment facility. There's a conversion facility that converts the uranium to the stuff that you need in order to produce a bomb. That was taken out. I mean, we're setting them back. We're hitting centrifuge manufacturing facilities, and we have a clear plan over the next several days to degrade and destroy their capabilities to produce and set them back several years. And in that sense, we're ahead of where we thought we would be on day four of this war. But we're going to achieve what we set out to achieve.
Minister Dermer, there's a report that President Trump vetoed an Israeli plan to kill Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Is that true?
I'm not going to get into any private conversations with U.S. officials. What I can tell you is the U.S. has been tremendous in the support that it's given Israel from the beginning of this war on defense. They have helped us with the Aegis ships to knock down these flying buses full of TNT that were landing on our cities, or that tried to land, were launched at our cities, I should say. They were helpful in the THAAD anti-missile system that you have. You also have American pilots in the air knocking down drones that are being launched at us from Iran. So we are deeply, deeply appreciative of everything that President Trump and his administration has done in order to defend and protect Israel. I mean, we're doing the job on offense and defense as well, but we appreciate everything that they have done to come to the defense of Israel. It's deeply, deeply appreciated, not just by the Prime Minister of Israel and the Governor of Israel, by all the people of Israel. Mm-hmm. We've never had a better friend in the White House than President Trump. And our greatest ally in the world is the United States of America. And I think there's an understanding, frankly, Joe, in America, and not just Israel, that when we are fighting Iran, we're not just fighting for ourselves. We're fighting an enemy of the United States. I mean, these people lead millions, these leaders in Iran, the tyrants of Tehran, they lead millions of people in chance of death to America. So when we're taking them on, we are fighting your fight. And it actually, our victory will also be an American victory. And I think it will help turn the region into a different direction. I think you're going to see that
a lot of the Gulf states help?
And maybe they appear on your show and maybe they'll be critical of that. And maybe they'll issue a pro forma condemnation. But believe me, in capitals throughout the Gulf and throughout the region, people who have lived under the shadow of Iran's campaign of carnage and chaos and terrorism throughout the region, they are rejoicing now. And my hope is that we're going to,
are you asking
war,
the U.S. to get involved offensively?
No, I think the United States is going to have to do whatever is it sees, and the president is ultimately the one that makes that decision, whatever it sees it's in America's interest. And I have full faith and confidence that the president will make that decision, whatever he believes is in the American national interest. But I think one thing you should keep your eye on, Joe, is what happened, what is happening within Iran. Our fight is not with the Iranian people. We have no problem in Israel with the Iranian people, and America should not have a problem with the Iranian people. They're actually a very pro-American population, probably second to Israel in the entire Middle East. It's the regime, and that regime subjugates them and also terrorizes all of its neighbors, including our Arab neighbors, while calling for Israel's destruction and ultimately for America's destruction. Remember, we're the little Satan, and they call you the great Satan. So pay attention to what is happening inside Iran when you see the fires starting to spark against the regime. And believe me, Joe, the thing that is most concerning for the leader of Iran is that his people will turn on him and his regime, because after nearly a half century of tyranny, they've had it. You saw them come to the streets in 2009. You saw them go to the streets in 2022. And they may actually go now. And he's very, very worried about that. So we're going to wage our war to achieve our goals. But keep your eye on what the people of Iran are doing.
We will. Of course we will. You've made a number of references to what happens after this, Minister Dermer. And I'm curious to just extend that a little bit. Whether this conflict ends at the negotiating table or on the battlefield, however this happens, will it also bring an end to your war with Iranian proxies? Will it mean an end to fighting in Gaza?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. A war was launched against us on October 7th by one of Iran's proxies, Hamas. And you see what we've done since then, when Iran basically opened many fronts against Israel. Hezbollah in the north, the Houthis in the south in Yemen, Shia militias in Iraq, various different Iranian proxies in Syria, and also directly from Iran itself. So we've been fighting this war, but look what we've done. We have crushed Hamas in Gaza. And we essentially have decapitated Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran was this very powerful and dangerous octopus with all of these arms. And what happened is those arms, those octopus arms, have turned into T-Rex arms now, and we have cut them down to size. Now, in the wake of this war, you say, well, how is it going to be end diplomatically? Well, you know, Japan ended diplomatically too. You just had a surrender ceremony. What was it, the USS Missouri? Well, you signed some documents. Now, we're not looking to occupy Iran. We don't have a territorial conflict with them. I don't think the United States is interested in putting boots on the ground anywhere they don't have to in the Middle East. That's not the question. Right. The question is, in the wake of this war, can we then make it clear to Iran that they have to end their support for terror proxies? They have to give up these ballistic missiles. They're in violation of international law. They have to end permanently any attempt for a military nuclear capability. They want a peaceful nuclear program. There are dozens of countries around the world that have nuclear reactors. Sure. They don't domestically enrich uranium, and they can do that. Those are the terms of what enable us, I think, to get to an end of the war and then to move on to the business of making peace and continuing where President Trump left off at the end of his first term, when we made peace with four Arab states, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. We should move that to other Gulf countries. And I think there'll be a lot of surprises that will come in the wake of this war, when you're going to see actually peace deals start happening much faster than people think.
Okay. I want to ask you in our remaining moment, Minister, because it's important. We're seeing a lot of numbers here. I want to ask you about casualties and what's really happening on the ground. The National Emergency Services, at least 21 people identified as civilians, have been killed in Iran's retaliatory strikes since Friday. Is that number still accurate?
I think that number now is up to 25, unfortunately. I'm not certain. You know, when you fire these ballistic missiles into civilian areas, and they're doing it. Remember, we're targeting terrorists in Tehran. We have the power to simply, you know, carpet bomb whole cities. We don't do that. We're only targeting terrorists and trying to get the innocents in Tehran and elsewhere of Iran out of harm's way. We're telling people, just today, we took out the National Broadcasting Service, which I'm telling the people of Iran, I think we're rejoicing over that, but we got people to evacuate all the areas around it. They're not telling us where they're going to fire. They want to kill as many people as possible, and they're slinging these huge flaming buses into downtown Tel Aviv. You see it on your television screens. So I think we're fortunate that the casualties have not been even more than 25, even though that it's a terrible a tragedy for each and every one of those families. But given what has been thrown at us and fired at us, I think it speaks to how the Israelis have acted under fire and what kind of resolve that they have, and they're running into their safe rooms, staying in the safe rooms and acting with a great deal of discipline that our home front command is constantly encouraging them, get into those safe rooms because those are the places where it's really, really unlikely that they're going to be hurt. And we've seen terrible scenes of destruction, but unfortunately, fewer casualties than otherwise people would have expected.
We're glad that you could spend some time with us today, Minister, and we'd like to stay close with you as this all develops. Ron Dermer is Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. We thank you for your time. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. As we follow the bead to Canada, this is the backdrop for the G7 summit that's getting underway right now. The open just took place. And Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern following President Trump to Banff, where she is right now. Meetings getting underway. In fact, we already brought you some images of the president with Prime Minister Carney. He also sat down with Germany's Chancellor Merz. Anne-Marie, it's great to have you with us here. You've had many conversations with Ron Dermer, and you can hear the passion in his voice today. How is this adding to the conversation in Canada?
Well, I think one thing is very clear when you hear from Ron Dermer is that the United States has been absolutely supporting Israel in its defense. Of course, a key question when we saw this attack originally take place is how much the United States know and how much support has the United States given Israel in the offense. At the moment, and the president said this over the weekend to ABC News, that they are not involved in it right now, but it would become, quote, possible to get involved. They have been very involved in terms of helping Israel strike down missiles and drones, but they have not yet joined in terms of the offense. And Joe, you asked an excellent point when it comes to Fordo, the nuclear facility that experts for years have said it would be very impossible for Israel to strike alone and actually hit that nuclear facility, given the fact how it's buried into deep into the mountain. And we have already heard from the IAEA today that Fordo stands fine and has not been hit. But Ron Dermer didn't want to get into any of those specifics, but just coming back to the point that the U.S. has been a great support. Now, at the same time, the president was asked about these reports in the Wall Street Journal that Iran is using back channels, trying to get some Arab countries to convince President Trump to put some weight on Benjamin Netanyahu for a ceasefire. And the president said, yeah, the Iranians want to talk. The president also said something has been repeating for days, which is that he gave Iran months for a diplomatic off-ramp. He's talking about some 60 days, but actually, Joe, I reported in mid-March that that first letter went over to the Ayatollah, giving them a timeline to have talks, to have nuclear talks. We were supposed to see the sixth round of those nuclear talks with Steve Witkoff, his envoy, in Oman yesterday. And obviously, Joe, those talks did not go through.
So what's going to come from this meeting then, Anne-Marie? We understand there won't even be as much as a communique. Bloomberg is writing about the extent to which Donald Trump loathes the G7. What's the point of getting everyone together?
Well, there won't be a communique, and I think that was a tactical, strategic plan from Mark Carney and his team, because they remember what happened to then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in 2018 when Trump left the summit, didn't sign off on the communique. So what they're doing this time around is they're trying to find points that all of these leaders can actually agree upon and put statements about those issues. So think of critical minerals or AI. A key question is whether or not we could get a statement now that this has overshadowed the summit, if we could get some sort of statement from these leaders when it comes to Iran and Israel. So you will see specific statements, but it won't be an overreaching communique that you would normally see in a G7. We should also note that the president here, besides, of course, what is going on in the Middle East and this concern for the world about a wider regional war, they are going to obviously be discussing trade. He is in the midst of a trade war with not just Canada, and he talked about that at the top of his more than hour meeting with Mark Carney. He said, I have a tariff concept. Mark has something different. But trade is going to be really key. He bought USTR, Jamison Greer, as well as the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. Two individuals have been leading on these trade talks. So the European Union wants to make sure that they have these conversations on trade, as well as Mexico's president, who is preparing for her first one-on-one meeting with Donald Trump.
Great reporting. Anne-Marie Hordern with us from Banff, a beautiful location to hopefully get people in a room to have some serious conversations. They'll be meeting in Kananaskis in Canada, and we'll let you know what comes from the G7 with the help of Anne-Marie and Bloomberg's David Gura, who was with us a bit earlier. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. Glad you came along. I can't wait to hear what the panel thinks about all of this. Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis are coming up.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
On Bloomberg TV and radio, YouTube, and Bloomberg Originals, it's great to have you along as we assemble our political panel following 4 days of attacks between Israel and Iran. And a fascinating conversation, a newsy conversation with Ron Dermer that started our hour. Of course, the former ambassador to the U.S., Israel's former ambassador, he's now Minister of Strategic Affairs, generating a lot of news here, and pretty remarkable to hear him talk about American pilots in the air over the weekend helping to knock down missiles, ballistic missiles shot by Iran at Israel. He described them as massive burning buses falling into the middle of civilian neighborhoods and cities across Israel. It was difficult to get some hard answers on U.S. involvement offensively. He essentially kept that on the U.S. and said that Israel has a clear plan to set Iran back several years with its nuclear program. Wouldn't get specific about Fordo or some of the other nuclear sites, the enrichment sites that Israel has been targeting, but also does not appear ready to get back to the table, with reports today that Iran is signaling through intermediaries that it wants to return to nuclear talks. President Trump, in fact, was asked about that earlier today at the G7, and he did acknowledge that that was the case. Let's assemble our political panel now for their take. Bloomberg Politics contributors Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis are with us. Rick is our Republican strategist partner at Stone Court Capital. Jeannie, senior democracy fellow with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. After everything you just heard, Rick, does that sound like a situation in which the United States will begin providing offensive support in Israel's attack against Iran?
Yeah, Joe, I think it just depends upon how you define offensive support. Look, we've consistently put up defense of Israel assets, ships in the Mediterranean to shoot down missiles from the Houthis and from Iran. We share intelligence actively with Israel in order to not just defend their country, but also keep an eye on Iran. And so you could argue that some of those things could be deemed offensive, but it is not the intention, based on what this administration has articulated, that we will get into a fight with Iran, right? And Donald Trump's been very careful. Even just Saturday, he was saying, gee, we hope that Iran shows up on Sunday for the negotiations, because the only way that this is going to end is with a treaty of some kind. And so I think he wants to play in so much as you can, if you're Donald Trump, the good cop. And by the way, what would that treaty look like tomorrow, based on what they were talking about yesterday? Yesterday, there were all kinds of questions about, you know, getting them to stop enriching uranium. I think that it's pretty clear that Israel's strategy and what they're executing on right now is going to keep that from being able to happen. So what's to negotiate there? I love the fact that Ron Dermer, former ambassador to the U.S., has said that we also want to include ballistic missiles in that. No more ballistic missiles being manufactured by Iran. And I wouldn't be surprised that even before the end of this current attack is over, that they'll start talking about no more drone manufacturing. And of course, that would help our friends in Ukraine immensely, because they are exporting terror by, you know, basically selling their drones around the world to groups that want to put Americans and other democratic nations in harm's way.
All right, Jeannie, what do you think? Is it possible for the U.S. to walk this line, providing logistical support, essentially, and defensive support to the extent that we've seen American airmen in the air, men and women presumably in the air, knocking down ballistic missiles fired by Iran? There's reporting that the U.S. Nimitz is on its way now, another carrier group to the region. We've surged so much material. Is it possible that we could sleepwalk into something larger?
That's absolutely the fear, is that this escalates. And as things go in a conflict like this, as violent and as long as this goes, that the U.S. is somehow dragged in. And of course, yesterday, the president said that it is possible we could be active in this conflict. So I think that is still a possibility. It was such a fascinating conversation, Joe, because you could just feel the passion in the minister's voice as he talked about this incredibly difficult issue. And one of the things he raised was, you know, hopefully he said, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, after we are done, we live in a more peaceful Middle East. And, you know, here to that, the question always is, what does the final day or the day after the final day look like on both sides? What is the end? And that is still not clear. We can see from all the reports that Iran is overgunned, outmaneuvered, outmatched. Israel has the upper hand. They have been decimated in Iran. The proxies have been decimated, but there is no certainty that they don't go underground after this is all over. And what happens after we regime change, which is what Israel has been talking about, if we see a regime change, hopefully that regime is more peaceful and more friendly to the United States, to Israel, and the Middle East. But that has not been what we've seen in history. So that is the big question I have. What does this look like when this finally comes to an end? And I know the president is saying Iran is talking about coming back to the table for talks. How do you have talks about a nuclear peace agreement when your nuclear capabilities have been decimated, if that's indeed what happens at the end of this? So I think there's a lot more questions here about the end, and a lot fewer answers and understanding as to what that looks like and whether we are in fact actually living in a world that is more peaceful here and in the Middle East.
Rick, Ron Dermer said Israel has already dismantled the Natanz site. This is Iran's main nuclear enrichment facility, and we know that they had launched those attacks on Friday. There are questions, and I asked Minister Dermer about what happens to Fordo. This is the enrichment site that is hundreds and hundreds of feet beneath rock. And it is believed that Israel can't reach that far underground without the help of U.S. bunker busters, if they, in fact, can get there. Should we be trained on this site? Does Israel feel that it needs to close the deal in Fordo?
Well, I think that if they had the means, Moab's mother of all bombs, bunker busters, that I have no doubt that they would probably have targeted that site earlier on, but they know there are limitations. They have, you know, fantastic precision guidance weapons, missiles, but when you bury something deep into a mountainside, it's trickier to get to. And maybe that is the sum and substance of ultimately a peace deal, is that inspectors get to go in and we make sure those centrifuges are dismantled and they're monitoring. And so rather than destroy it with offensive means, you get rid of it through the negotiation process. And yet, I think it's very clear from your interview with Ron Dermer that Israel will not stop hostilities till they get the deal they want. And he was not willing to describe what that deal looks like, but I'm pretty confident that the two existential threats that he described of ballistic missiles and a nuclear program have to go away in order for this fight to stop.
Are you surprised at the way this has unfolded, Jeannie? I've mentioned this a few times over the past couple of days. People our age grew up thinking that this would be the beginning of World War III, that this was the line you couldn't cross, to have Israel, in fact, go to war with Iran. But seeing Iran as crippled as it was going into this, with its missile defenses attacked repeatedly by Israel. It's changed the way we're looking at this entire dynamic. You've got a stock market today that's up hundreds of points, even as this takes place in the Middle East. Are we missing something here?
You know, I think that is how we grew up, and it is a very scary proposition. This has been, Israel knew they had to go in now if they were going to go in at all, because, of course, Iran was weakened severely, as were the proxies. I think the concern, again, is that there is no guarantee that they stay weakened, and that is one of the scary aspects of this. There is this assumption that we take out this regime and what follows is much friendlier to the Middle East and to the United States. And that is not necessarily the case. Do they go underground like North Korea and build a bomb? They have the knowledge, they have the means, they have the capacity. So those are all very scary propositions. And we should also add, from a domestic standpoint, Donald Trump is finding himself in a domestic conundrum here on both this issue and immigration, similarly, where the MAGA right is standing up all weekend on these two issues and saying, you have abandoned your promise. So much so he came back and say, MAGA policy is whatever I say it is. But that is also a real threat to Donald Trump domestically.
Great conversation, as always, with Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis. I appreciate your insights. Bloomberg Politics contributors for a reason. We're going to talk more about the market reaction or lack thereof to what we're seeing here in the Middle East and drill down on energy. Bob McNally from Rapidan is going to be with us to talk about what this means for the energy complex next on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
It is pretty remarkable. Stocks up, VIX down, oil down. Doesn't sound like a world in which we're on the precipice of a global conflict breaking out in the Middle East. Unless Charlie Pellett is whistling past the graveyard here, we have a pretty decent market on our hands after 4 days of attacks between Israel and Iran. I want to spend some time with Christine Aquino, who covers the markets for us, Bloomberg's managing editor for Markets, live with us on Bloomberg. Christine, thanks so much for joining from New York. Why do investors seem so confident? Is it just a matter of one headline that Iran is looking for an off-ramp?
Well, Joe, you know, the history of markets is that they are notoriously bad at pricing geopolitical risk. And, you know, the same goes for what we're seeing now in this latest bout of the Middle East conflict. We did see that initial knee-jerk negative reaction on Friday when news of Israel's initial strike against Iran emerged. And, you know, since over the weekend, we have seen investors being willing to recalibrate their appetite for risk. And clearly that's leaning more toward the risk positive side of things. I mean, there's definitely the headline that Iran is potentially willing to de-escalate, helping sentiment a little bit. But more broadly, you know, there is still this very bullish sentiment in markets, particularly in stocks.
Well, I guess this can take on a life of its own. But what are you looking at? What sectors are powering this higher?
Well, Joe, you know, we're seeing the traditional sectors, semiconductors, definitely one of the sectors that are powering this rally. You're talking about your Magnificent Seven stocks, your big tech. And that tends to be what we see, you know, in during the times of a rebound in markets, all these mega cap stocks that tend to get battered when risk sentiment pulls back. They're the ones that lead a rally right out of the gate when we're starting the week on a more positive note like this. The other thing I think to keep watch on is the dollar, because you know, its relationship with risk aversion really has been shifting a lot. You know, gone are the days when the dollar is an ultimate gain or an automatic gain because of risk aversion. It seems like it's more responding to developments domestically, particularly as we have the Federal Reserve decision later this week.
Really interesting to see most of the big defense names coming back down to earth after the big rally we saw last week. Lockheed, Northrop, L3, all down 3% or more at this stage of the game, which we'll be following for you here. Christine, it's great to have you. We appreciate your read on the markets. Come see us again here on Balance of Power. Live from New York, Christine Aquino from our markets team. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington as we zero in a little bit more closely on energy and more specifically oil. We're, as I mentioned, looking at lower prices today. That goes for WTI and that goes for Brent. Down about 1.5% each following a little bit of an uptick last week, a more severe uptick right at the outset of Israel's attack on Iran. We can't have this conversation without Bob McNally. I've been looking forward to doing this for a couple of days here to get his read, the founder and president, Rapidan Energy Group, former White House energy advisor in the George W. Bush administration. Bob, welcome back. It's great to see you. Should this market be more concerned?
Great to be with you, Joe. You know, I think it should, but you know what? You have to cut it some slack. We have a pattern here where we've had scary geopolitical disruption events going back to September of 2019 when the Iranians hit the Saudi Abqaiq stabilization plant, most important oil facility in the world, had the biggest open in Sunday and for crude oil markets ever, but it didn't last. The Iranians chose to inflict light reversible damage. Russian invasion of Ukraine, crude prices spiked, ended up being a nothing burger.
How about that?
We've had the Houthis disrupt the, you know, Bab al-Mandab hasn't roiled global oil markets. Mm-hmm. And Israel and Iran have come to blows twice last year and now, and we still see oil flowing through Hormuz and being produced. So it's understandable why the market would say, boy, you cried wolf. I've seen this movie before.
Call me back when something changes.
What if Iran does close
the Strait of Hormuz? We keep hearing this. Is that the worst case scenario for the oil market?
It's right up there. In my view, the worst case is a damaging attack on the Abqaiq stabilization plant.
Okay.
There is no more important and valuable piece of real estate on planet Earth. Mm. One facility stabilizes and controls about 7 million barrels a day of Saudi production. The Iranians hit it once just to show that they could. They didn't do damage.
Huh.
If they went back and destroyed that facility, Joe, we'd be in a depression. Oil would go to 150 in a week and then down to 20, and it would be really the end of the world as we know it. At 7% of world oil supply gone. Now, Strait of Hormuz is 18 million barrels a day, about 5 million barrels a day of product, 13 million barrels a day of crude. Not a lot of redirects. You can put a little bit out through Yanbu in the Red Sea and a little bit out through UAE, through Habshan, but basically you're losing 15, 14 million barrels a day.
Uh-huh.
Our strategic stocks can't cover that. Even if they were full, mm-hmm. they couldn't cover that. So, yeah, that's right up there as a second worst, I would think.
Neither of these appear to be expected by this market. It gets back to the boy who cried wolf, to your point here. We had Ron Dermer on the program at the top of the hour, Minister for Strategic Affairs in Israel. And he's talking a tough game. They're not done. They're not near being done, according to Ron Dermer, who talked about not only eliminating the nuclear threat, but the ballistic missile threat.
Right.
That's going to require a lot more sorties and could potentially change the nuances of this conflict. Short of the worst case scenarios you're mapping out, what else should we have our eyes on?
Well, you know, Israel is a changed country after 10/7/23.
Mm.
And the plan was always Gaza, Lebanon, and then Iran. And we're into the Iran phase.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're even hinting at regime destabilization, if not destruction. They're emptying Tehran, et cetera. So Israel is not going to stop until it achieves its objectives, very least neutralizing nuclear facilities, ballistic missiles, and possibly destabilizing that regime. And I don't believe President Trump is going to stop Israel from doing that. So I would think that Iran has to play the only card it has. It doesn't have military escalation dominance with us or with Israel. The only card Iran has is to threaten the thing that scares President Trump perhaps the most.
Mm.
And that is $5 gasoline here.
Okay.
And so
and
whether
it could make that happen.
Yeah, it can make that happen. And this debate is out there. We shouldn't expect if the United States were to become militarily engaged against Iran or Iran were to try to close the straits, it wouldn't be like the first Gulf War or the second Gulf War where the U.S. prevailed militarily in hours to days. No, it would not be a cakewalk. Look at the Houthis, who are inferior to Iran, yet they are keeping us at bay.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is able to shut that strait for some period of time, a lot longer than the market thinks. So I think they may have to demonstrate that they're willing to do that, to get this crude price back up, to try to convince President Trump to rein in the Israelis. In a way, it's the only card they have.
Fascinating. You've been preparing for this moment probably for a long time as somebody in the oil space. What's different about Iran and its standing in the oil market, its importance and scale in the oil market now than, say, back in the 1970s when an embargo had such an impact on our lives.
Yeah, you know, back in the 1970s, especially the early 1970s, the United States was the Saudi Arabia, the swing producer, the spare capacity holder of oil. Going back a little earlier, late 1960s, Arab-Israeli war, Arab oil embargo didn't matter because the United States had a safe, ample buffer and spare. But as we went through the 1970s, that went over to OPEC, and the United States lost control. Yeah. And here we are with a 100 million barrel a day market with maybe 3-4 million barrels a day of spare, and all of the spare is in the war zone in the Arabian Gulf.
Okay.
So we're in a pickle, and the world's in a pickle. And what I think people may not realize, in the 70s, the United States knew we were vulnerable because we were losing control. The imports were rising. What people may think now is because of shale oil, because the U.S. is a net oil exporter. I hear this all the time. Yeah. We don't need the Middle East.
Yes.
We don't need the oil. Yes, we do, because the price of oil is what we really care about, what our consumers and businesses and investors care about, the price you pay for it, not where it comes
from.
That
which is global.
And whether we're an importer or an exporter, whether we're big or small, if there's a disruption anywhere, prices go up everywhere.
In the meantime, Israel attacking Iranian energy sites means an energy crisis in Iran or beyond the region?
So it depends on what targets they attack.
Yeah.
So if they're attacking local oil terminals, like outside of Tehran, like they did, or the South PARS 14, Phase 14 gas
saw
field.
Saw that yesterday.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a problem for Iran.
Okay.
That's not a problem for Mr. and Mrs. America. That's not a problem for our Exxon station.
Israel surely knows this.
That's right. And so the Iranians hit the Haifa refinery. Mm-hmm. These are hitting domestic facilities in Iran and Israel. It's concerning because they're spreading beyond military targets. Mm-hmm. However, it hasn't yet hit flows or production that matter for the world.
Sure.
And that's why crude is off today and folks are not so much worried.
Isn't that something? This is all remarkable to hear about. As I think about your answer on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, we talked to the Energy Secretary last week. Chris Wright said it would take years. We've heard this constantly from the administration. They say, first we have to repair the caverns, and then we can start bidding. It's going to be a years-long process. But, Bob, it sounds like we don't have years. Based on what you just said, we might need that oil.
Yeah, you know, sometimes our biggest mistakes are bipartisan. And Congress, in its wisdom, both parties, starting about 5-10 years ago, started selling off the SPR just because we thought we didn't need it.
Hmm.
And then President Biden sold about 180 million barrels, you know, when there was no emergency with Russia. We didn't lose any Russian oil. Had we lost Russian oil, would have been a reason there wasn't. So here we are, half of the reserve is full. Secretary's right. Wright is right. We'd have to be slow to refill it. I was working for President Bush, and we did it through a royalty in kind program, and it took us years to get back to the tippy top.
So you've already done this.
I've done it. I was there in the White House after 9/11.
Wow.
I was there for the second Gulf War. Uh-huh. We thought through the type of barrel flow and contingency planning, where are inventories, where is spare capacity, and the math gets pretty grim if we lose the Strait of Hormuz or Abqaiq, with or without an SPR.
If that happened, you'd have to release what was left in there now?
They would. I think we'd organize a release between us, and then the Japanese and the Germans hold most of the other stocks.
I see.
But we're talking about maybe 2 to 3 million barrels a day of flow. Hormuz is 18 total, maybe some redirects, we're losing 15.
Wow.
So 15 is a lot more than, you know, three.
Fascinating. It comes down to barrels, as you always say.
It comes down to barrels. And you know, there's an iron law of economics. You can't consume what you can't produce.
Oh, true.
And the price is like the police officer that enforces that rule. And if you lose 15 and you only can grab 13 from SPR and you can't produce more in a hurry, we've got to consume that much less. And the price will do that by going up.
What does this mean for the big oil names, Exxon, Chevron, and so forth? Their stocks are hardly moving.
And I understand that. This is not a good thing for them. You know, we've seen wars in the Arabian Gulf lead to oil price spikes. Mm-hmm. But what comes after that? Recessions, demand downturns, and price drops. This is not a good thing if you're an oil company or an oil producer.
Yeah.
Now, what would be interesting is if there is regime change in Iran and you could get private companies operating in that country with the world's third largest oil reserves, gas reserves, third largest oil reserves. So there's a lot of oil there. And if Iran were to have regime change, peace and stability would be strengthened. But for the oil companies, though, these momentary spikes are dangerous.
Really interesting.
I think it's the same thing for OPEC countries as well.
Having listened to Bob McNally for a couple of minutes here, you're not terribly worried yet, but things could change very quickly. Is that a fair assessment?
You're right. I'm not terribly worried, but I'm more worried than we are today. Here we are in the markets. Mm-hmm. I would not be buying this sell-off here.
Okay.
I think we're going to be going higher before we go lower. I think this is not over yet.
Fascinating, as always. Bob McNally, Rapidan, great conversation. I'm so glad that you could come in. It's always great to have you here in the nation's capital. I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. Glad you're with us as well.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
With a bit of euphoria in the markets here following the big headline in the Wall Street Journal. Pretty interesting. Iran is looking for an off-ramp. Maybe that's not a shocker. But following predictions of World War III, that sounds pretty good to a Wall Street trader today. We're going to get to the bottom of whether that is actually founded. With President Trump appearing a short time ago, G7, Canada, David Gura just brought us up to date, remembering that this is the alliance he loathes. According to the headline on Bloomberg, he appeared with Mark Carney a short time ago and was asked about the situation. Might be a good time to bring in Tyler Kendall into this conversation. Bloomberg's Washington correspondent is with me here on Balance of Power. With the president abroad, the conversation has been just as dicey, and we're picking up where we left off last week, Tyler, with regard to any number of national security concerns. The big one, of course, is Iran and Israel. They're going to be talking about Ukraine and Russia at the G7. With President Zelensky on the invite list, too.
Yeah, definitely, Joe. And President Trump, actually, what we were going to hear is that he appeared to confirm reports that Iran really does want to de-escalate here. Mm. He says that he heard that they want to talk, and he reiterated to them that they should make a deal before it's too late. Now, you're mentioning the other geopolitical conflicts. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we have to keep in mind the White House went into this G7 summit thinking that trade was actually going to be the priority and that they could show some sort of forward progress here as we are now within that one-month deadline to July 9th.
Yeah, it's amazing to think back up a couple of weeks. You would think this would be all about tariffs. And the world has, of course, once again shifted under our feet, which is why it's a great pleasure to bring in Christopher Smart. He's with us in studio right now, founder, managing partner, Arbroath Group, former special assistant to the president at the National Economic Council and the Obama administration. Christopher, great to see you in Washington.
Great to be with you.
Glad you're back with us. It's pretty interesting when you back away from this ever-changing world. You've got Wall Street on a tear today, but your note to clients would suggest that recession odds are rising. How do you have both?
Well, it's short-term, long-term, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had gone home Thursday night and not looked at the news until this morning or not looked at the markets until this morning, you would assume everything was fine and nothing had changed since then, given what's happened to the stock prices and to bond prices, and even the oil prices kind of cooled off a little bit since then. I think the immediate risks of what we see unfolding in the Middle East appear to not have much impact on global oil supply, particularly since the Saudis and OPEC have been pumping a lot of oil since the beginning of the year and the global economy is slowing down. But there's always that risk, and that's why markets look a little jumpier right now, that we're going to get some outsized event closing down the Straits of Hormuz or something that really does upset that balance.
Is that the event that keeps you up at night? Because we all grew up, Christopher, with the idea that if Israel were to go to war with Iran, that's over. This is World War III time. You've heard Donald Trump say it himself. He grew up in that same environment. Are we learning otherwise?
I think we're learning otherwise because the folks lining up on the other side of the equation behind Iran aren't lining up very closely behind the Ayatollah and the current government. You have President Putin, who is one of Iran's allies, offering to mediate the conversation rather than saying he's backing Iran to the hilt.
Yeah.
You've heard very little from China other than let's try and de-escalate this thing and everything should be solved through negotiations. So it appears at least right now to be contained. But obviously when you've got that kind of exchange of missiles back and forth, the risk of something going astray and some other U.S. asset being hit is always there.
Well, I wanted to build on this because President Trump, of course, is at the G7. But as you mentioned, he took a call not from a G7 ally over the weekend, but from the Russian president. And then also we've heard from him actually just moments ago at the G7 saying that he would potentially welcome if China did come into these talks because he needs somebody that Iran would speak to. So when it comes to these strategic alliances that Iran does have, will they really make an impact at the end of the day?
It's hard to see how they will, particularly because Israel, frankly, is winning right now and looks like it is going to be able to drive the military balance as far as it wants to go. And so that's why you see, I think, these overtures on behalf of Iran to say, let's talk. But again, it's hard to see how involving either Russia or China improves the prospects for peace as long as Israel continues to have its eye on the ball, which appears to be completely disarming Iran's military and maybe doing enough weakening of the regime to see if something new and better can replace it.
Sorry, Tyler, go ahead.
No, I was going to bring the picture actually to domestic issues here as we have this interest rate decision, of course, on Wednesday. I'm wondering how you're seeing these tensions in the Middle East complicate an already complicated picture for the FOMC.
Well, I think it gives the FOMC yet another excuse to do nothing because the uncertainty of the oil price compounds the uncertainty around tariffs. Usually an oil price spike is something that monetary authorities try and look through and as a one-off. But the volatility and the impact on expectations, I think, is where the Fed will be focused most of all, as it has been looking at the tariff equation.
What do you think when you're looking at Donald Trump at the G7, talking about as if it was something done in error, Vladimir Putin, Russia somehow kicked out of the alliance, very skeptical of our allies in Europe, kind of poking Mark Carney, not with the 51st state, but a lot he's referring to the former prime minister and so forth. The transatlantic rift, does Wall Street care about this? We talk about it a lot at home. What about the market?
I think it's hard for markets to price it in on a day-to-day basis. I think where you really do start seeing it impacted is when you talk to some of my clients who are corporates with global footprints, certainly transatlantic footprints, and feel frozen, not sure quite where to build their next factory, quite where to sign the next contract with their supplier.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that's likely to play through, not day to day, but month to month and even year to year. I think the difficulty with how to interpret the president's statements, I think he really is focused on he wants to do deals and he wants peace deals. I'm not sure he thinks about what happens beyond the peace deal or after you come to agreement with Putin on Ukraine. Does that embolden him? Does that upset the balance of power? Does that change the global order? I'm not sure he thinks in those terms. Mm-hmm. He's really just looking to find a way forward for Iran, for Gaza, for Ukraine, see if he can secure those kinds of understandings without necessarily thinking about what they mean for the next steps.
Yeah.
From peace deals to trade deals, which of course was supposed to really be the other big focus of the summit.
Indeed.
We had the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Capitol Hill last week saying that it is highly likely that some of these trading partners are going to get an extension beyond July 9th, those ones that have been prioritized in these talks. In your note, you talk about investment in the U.S. I'm wondering what that would mean for investment decisions in this country if we see certain countries perhaps see those rates go back up to where they were on April 2nd and others get an extended pause.
Well, I think that's the problem with the way this has all been rolled out is that the uncertainty is very high. And whether there is a deal that gets done with a country, will it be renegotiated because something else comes up? How can you start planning with your trade flows and your suppliers that may come out of the UK without knowing what's going to happen with the EU? How do you understand your global auto supply chain without a deal in place with Japan? I mean, there are lots of very complicated interlocking pieces to this puzzle. And as long as most of them remain undecided and uncertain, I think that is where you build the uncertainty into business decisions. And I'll just say one more thing. Sooner or later, companies are going to have to make decisions. They can't be frozen forever. And so they're going to have to make more costly decisions. It's going to eat into their earnings. It's going to eat into the returns that investors should be expecting.
Well, wait a minute. What happened to 90 deals in 90 days, Christopher?
Well, deals are deals. But what we've been getting is sort of handshakes on a framework for the potential of a memorandum of understanding rather than a trade deal.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of thing that make investors crazy because, you know, they need to decide what particular tariff line their particular product falls into and what extra charge is going to be for that rather than a framework for, you know, working this out over a period of weeks and months.
What about sector-specific tariffs? How are you watching those? Because that seems to be the more longer-lasting, perhaps more durable solution from this administration when we do see the so-called reciprocal tariffs get more of a pushback. And I'm particularly fascinated by the fact that these sector-specific tariffs weren't supposed to be in those original negotiations on so-called Liberation Day.
No, indeed. And I think that is, you know, given the court pushbacks on some of these tariffs that are based on the president's international emergency authorities that courts are deciding to rule against, the much stronger leg that the president and the administration has to rest on are these sectoral tariffs, whether it's on steel, whether it's on pharmaceuticals, or the automotive sector. And I think those are the kinds of things that are potentially much more disruptive to the global economy, because it's not just a single bilateral relationship that they're impacting, but pharmaceuticals, autos, steel. And I think that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to keep our eye on.
No communique is expected to come from this G7. How little we're getting along.
I think they've learned their lesson.
Yeah, that didn't go great in 2018, I guess.
It didn't go great in 2018. Communiques, I think, are important when you do have agreement, because it does help frame things. But they also tend to highlight the disagreement.
So is this the tree that fell in the woods, G7?
Well, it's a complicated G7, right? Because we were expecting to have some clarity on trade. If nothing else, you know, there's still talk that there might be a bilateral deal with India or Japan announced, because the president will be meeting with both of those leaders. Yeah. But I think generally it is being tremendously overshadowed by the news of the day, by what's going on the ground in Iran, in Israel, the potential for talking about Russia, talking about China in this context. So I think it's going to be hard to write that single headline coming out of the G7 that we might all prefer to be able to do.
This is the world that we're in. Yeah. Tyler, we've got an image of President Trump with the Chancellor of Germany. The meeting did happen. Chancellor Merz and the president, he's got a big smile. Looks like the meeting went pretty well. We'll see if anything comes of it and if the market wants to care about that today. Great pleasure to have Christopher Smart with us in studio, our Growth Group.
Great to be with you.
Toast to Boston and everyone in my former town when you get back home. Great to have you here in the nation's capital. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.